From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in November of 1776 in the marshes of Lake Maggiore, which covers the border between Italy and Switzerland. An Italian physicist named Alessandro Volta was looking for something. He had recently read a paper written by Benjamin Franklin, a paper about flammable air. So Volta went to the marshes, and he captured some of the gas that was rising from the marsh. Within 2 years, he was able to isolate the pure gas, and he was able to demonstrate that he could ignite the gas with an electric spark. But it wasn't until 90 years later, 1866, when a German chemist coined the name for this gas, it does have a TH in it, it's methane. And this is our monthly science roundtable on Connections. We're going to focus heavily on methane, specifically examining methane in the Great Lakes and the impact on climate change. Carbon dioxide gets a lot of the love and the attention, well, sort of the anti-love, but scientists are paying increasing attention to methane and its impact on our atmosphere. Now, typically, our monthly science roundtable is the first Monday of each month, but some of the events surrounding the Black Lives Matter movement and the demonstrations this past weekend have forced us to shuffle our conversations this week, and so we're holding it now. Let me welcome our guest for the hour. John Kessler is here, Associate Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. Nice to see you back, John.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Nicola Weissman's here as well, and she is a University of Rochester Class of 2018 Environmental Studies major. Nicola, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And just briefly, I want to also drag in my colleague Veronica Volk, because Veronica is someone you know through WXXI reporting, podcasting, and many other things, but some of your mission is evolving and changing. What are you doing?
Yeah, so this is really appropriate for this discussion today, but I just wanted to take the opportunity for some shameless self-promotion.
Well, that's why we're here.
And some station promotion, of course. But basically what's happening is I'm part of this new project where WXXI and WBFO in Buffalo and IdeaStream in Cleveland have formed this like super collaborative of journalists, and we're going to be reporting on the Great Lakes specifically. We're talking environmental issues, economic issues, water, wildlife, all that kind of good stuff.
And that's what you're doing?
Yeah, so just
like now already.
Yeah, so I'm working on some stuff right now. Specifically, I'm working on a story right now about this little town called Alpena, Michigan. It's in the Rust Belt, and it was built on this industrial economy, and it's slowly rebranding itself as the shipwreck capital of the Great Lakes. And some of my other colleagues, Angelica Morrison at BFO, just did a great story on these vampire leech-like fish called the sea lamprey, invasive species, totally gross but really awesome. Elizabeth Miller at IdeaStream is working on this incredible series about drowning and the deadliest beach in the Great Lakes. So it's just going to be a lot of really awesome coverage. And of course, I'm a little biased, but I think that some of these topics and these issues are really important today. You have water quality issues coming up across the country. You have environmental issues, and climate change is a huge, you know, just a huge driver and a huge source of, you know, contention and conversation, and we're going to be talking about it.
How often are you going to get a chance to sort of go out and, obviously you're going to do what you can, but how often are you actually going to be either on the shores, on the lakes, and reporting sort of on scene?
That's a real goal of this collaborative. As you know, Evan, I'm kind of moving towards a role where I'm going to be doing more long-form mm-hmm. enterprise reporting, and it'll be a lot of out in the field. Of course, you know, in our newsroom, we always try to incorporate live sound from the community and from the environment. But this is going to be really heavy on that, because it's telling stories about, you know, the outdoors, about the Great Lakes, about this rich environment and this rich resource and it's a story you can't really tell without getting those sounds. So I'll be getting out a lot.
All right, and the unserious question is, are we going to do it like a new profile picture, like with your hair whipping in the breeze and you out on a boat?
Have you seen my new waders? Yeah, they got me waiting.
Do you have the waiters?
Yeah,
yes.
No, not really.
Oh, okay.
absolutely not. You got to maintain that professional appearance. But anyway, besides all that, you can follow us. The collaborative is called Great Lakes Today. We don't have a website yet. I'm told it's coming, but I don't know how that all works.
Okay.
But you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Great Lakes Today. You can follow us on Twitter @Great Lakes Today. It's where we're going to stockpile all of our stuff. So if you're on there, follow us, check us out.
All right. So Great Lakes Today. When you hear that, for example, on our various newscasts and whatnot, now you've got the background on it, what Great Lakes Today is, how to follow it. And when there is its own website or section, you'll be able to follow it and find it there. But you'll be hearing Veronica and her colleagues reporting on that. We're excited about that, excited for you. And thanks for coming in and telling us about it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and thanks for letting me tell everyone what's going on.
All right, Great Lakes Today reporter Veronica Volk joining us. And it's an appropriate start to our conversation on what's going on in our own Great Lake here. John Kessler, what is going on? You guys got something started roughly about a month ago. What's going on?
Well, that's the question that we're trying to answer as well.
Yes.
We really don't know at this point. What we do know is that aquatic environments, be it the oceans or rivers or lakes around the planet, are significant sources of greenhouse gases, many of the ones that we hear a lot about in the media, carbon dioxide and now creeping in a little bit more methane and nitrous oxide as well. We know that freshwater environments around the planet, while they're such a small fraction of the water on this planet, are actually enormous sources of these greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. And we know also that in certain locations, like up in the Arctic, that the source of these greenhouse gases, methane of which is one, is increasing as the temperature warms as well. What's so interesting is that the Great Lakes system is the largest liquid freshwater environment on the planet. Yet there's been almost no measurements of greenhouse gases, methane in particular, in the Great Lakes system. There's a few here and there, and they're starting to come out. But what our goal is to really change that in a major way and start a new research initiative where we can measure some of the distributions, the sources, the sinks, the release rates, and have a better understanding on what this natural source of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere might be.
The stereotype is that methane comes from cows, which it does. But I think what I want to do is work through some of what I've been reading, again, via NPR and other sources, to help establish some factual basis on methane. You can tell me where this research is right and wrong. And then I would invite listeners. This is a great time, I think, if you've got questions, to the extent that John and Nicola can answer them, they will. And but part of the point, John, is there's still a lot of things that we don't know, right, about methane and the impact?
Absolutely. There's a ton that we do know about greenhouse gases, about climate change. But some of these, what I call feedbacks, what a lot of people call feedbacks, as the planet warms, as the climate changes, it gets wetter or drier, how will some of these natural ecosystems be impacted? Will more greenhouse gases be emitted from them? Will less? These sorts of feedbacks are a major unknown, and hopefully through research of ours and others, we might be able to shed a little bit of light onto that.
Nicola, by the way, in this research project, what's your role?
So I'll be assisting out on the lake when we go out on the ship to make measurements of methane in the atmosphere and the water and all sorts of that. But I'll also be looking at local riverways, including the Genesee River, and how waterfalls pay an impact into methane release rates, methane entering the water, carbon dioxide as well. Because as water goes over these waterfalls, you see so much turbulence, a lot of air entrapment occurs, a lot of bubbles are formed, things like that. Air gets in, air is released, and so we don't really know what role that plays right now in greenhouse gases, whether they're entering the water, whether they're being released from the water, but we're hoping to find out, looking at local Genesee River through Rochester, High Falls, Lower Falls, and also going down to Letchworth State Park and maybe some other places along the way, maybe getting out to Niagara if we get the chance.
Again, have you started that research yet?
Not yet. I just recently got back to Rochester. I was out of the country for 4 weeks. So.
Okay. But John, some of the team have done, well, what exactly have you done so far?
Yeah, we're actually just in the infancy stages of this research. So I think this is a really exciting time for us to begin the conversation. We've established a collaborative relationship with SUNY Brockport. We are using, working with some of their scientists on one of their research vessels. We've gone out, we've tested some of our equipment, we've made just a few preliminary measurements, but it's within the next month that we're really ramping up and starting to make measurements hardcore, where we'll get the heat of the summer and the characteristics of the lake, and as Nicola mentioned, some of the rivers and streams and that are entering in and the influence influence that they may have on some of these greenhouse gas distributions. But then we'll also be able to sample throughout the fall and as late as we possibly can into the winter before Old Man Winter forces us off the waters. And so we get that seasonal transition to also be able to get some at least some preliminary data on how these distributions, how these fluxes change throughout the course of time.
All right, so you're getting a sense for the research coming from the University of Rochester. And before I get more specific on questions on how John and the team are planning to go out and to do certain measurements or what you're looking for, I just wanted to make sure we, again, go through some baseline facts on methane. Because first let me read, this is from NPR, and this is actually a story that's a couple of years old, so John, you can weigh in on this. Methane causes vicious cycle in global warming. And let me go ahead and read first, and then we'll kind of go over point by point. NPR writing, quote, carbon dioxide is the gas we most associate with global warming, but methane gas also plays an important role. For reasons that are not yet well understood, methane gas stopped increasing in the atmosphere in the 1990s, but now it appears to be once again on the rise. Scientists are trying to understand why and what to do about it. Methane gas comes from all sorts of sources, including wetlands, rice paddies, cow tummies, coal mines, garbage dumps, even termites. And Drew Schindel at NASA's Goddard Institute in New York says it's gone up by 150% since the pre-industrial period. That's an enormous increase. Carbon dioxide, by contrast, has gone up something like 30% in that time. So there, end quote. So that's from NPR. And here are some of what they establish as facts on this. Number one, first of all, molecule for molecule, methane is much more effective than carbon dioxide at trapping heat in the atmosphere. Yes?
True.
Okay, do we know why that is or what about it? Is that part of what our questions are?
There's a few different reasons why, but in general, these different molecules are very efficient at absorbing heat. And so different molecules will have different efficiencies at absorbing heat, and methane is one that's substantially more efficient than CO2. The only difference is that the concentration of methane in the atmosphere is also substantially less than CO2.
All right. Schindel from NASA says, quote, methane is much more complicated once it gets into the atmosphere than something like carbon dioxide is, and that's because it reacts with a lot of different important chemicals.
I would agree with that as well. If we look at atmospheric chemistry, the influence of, well, we hear on especially some hot days during the summer, ozone, even the ozone hole over the Antarctic, methane plays a role chemically in all of these processes that carbon dioxide doesn't do. Now, that said, the amount of time that methane spends in the atmosphere is significantly less than CO2. Carbon dioxide is involved in photosynthetic processes, which methane is by and large not. And so it's hard for me to say, yeah, it's a little bit more complex than the others, but they do have slightly different roles.
Okay. Bob and Menden, hang there. We're going to get to your phone call in just a second, but you mentioned ozone. NPR writes that methane in the atmosphere also creates ground-level ozone,
yep.
And ozone isn't only bad for human health. It also contributes to global warming. Schindel from NASA recently totaled up all the effects of methane emissions and realized that the heating effect is more than 60% that of carbon dioxide. So I guess the point about ozone is I felt like we heard so much more about the ozone 20 years ago than we do now. And I don't know if that's true, and maybe that's in my own perception. What do you think, John?
I'd say that's probably true. Just scanning the media and things like that, I do think it is an issue that doesn't get maybe as much play as some of the others. But that's because other environmental issues like climate change, mm-hmm. I think, has kind of taken front stage. At the same time, our understanding of ozone depletion, and that's higher up than ozone close to the ground, tropospheric ozone versus stratospheric ozone, our understanding of that is pretty solid. I think that also has contributed this to maybe getting a little bit less attention as we're starting to work on the solution.
Well, I was talking to a friend last night and getting ready for this story and reading this NPR story. I said, what do you remember about ozone? And he said, what I remember is everyone was using aerosol hairspray. We were told stop doing it. We did, and the ozone hole that was forming stopped forming, and everything is fine. I said, that's a pretty simple explanation. I think that might be oversimplifying it. But he said literally that's all I can really tell you about remembering about ozone coverage.
I would agree with that. Although I wouldn't say everything is fine
right,
at
yeah,
this
right.
point.
That was the addendum that I thought, I don't know.
Yes. In fact, I think we're certainly starting to get a little bit of afield from my level of expertise, but I did recently read an article that the ozone hole, while it still exists, is starting to recover. So I would say the everything is fine is probably not 100% true. But we are trending in the right direction. Now, methane does play a role in that. While it is some of the propellants in old aerosols that were causing the catalytic reaction to remove ozone, it was a reaction that had to occur on ice crystals high up in the atmosphere. And that water that formed those ice crystals was in large part coming from methane getting injected into the upper atmosphere.
Okay, let me grab a phone call. Bob in Mendon wants to weigh in with a question. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. I've noticed just the falls here in Honeyway Falls have no water trickling over it. So I'm wondering, with low water table now, with the lack of rain, is that going to adversely affect, or will it affect at all, the research you're going to be doing on the Great Lakes and the rivers?
I think that's a great question. It's one of the variables that we're going to have to consider, especially when we're on the Great Lakes. Now, Nicola's part in it, when she's working on the rivers, in an area of that nature, she's simply not going to be able to go to if there's no water and there's nothing going over the side. But there's so many different variables that can influence greenhouse gas distributions and natural waterways, be it carbon dioxide or methane or nitrous oxide or anything else. Temperature can be one, nutrient inputs, photosynthetic activity, what might be coming out of the ground, groundwater, some petroleum activities, hydrofracking people are worried about as well. So certainly drought is a big one, and how that may influence these distributions and these fluxes is one that we don't really know, because the research in this area is simply non-existent in this specific region. So we're trying to go out there and get a little bit of some of that preliminary understanding, and then we'll see where that takes us as the summer and the fall rolls in.
Nicola, you want to weigh in on that?
So I think that's definitely something to take into account, is these smaller waterways definitely vary a lot during the summer from increased heat and the such. So one of the things that I looked into when planning my field sites was trying to find areas with high water flow, with large, whether they be like large volumetric flows, in order to make sure that they will be available year round to study. But then from that, based off of the calculations we get with, you know, either methane being released, carbon dioxide, what have you, we might be able to, based off of what we find, extrapolate a little bit to figure out, smaller waterways, like what, for areas with much lower volumetric flow rates, like how do those play in, how do areas like Niagara Falls, which has an immense amount of water that's transported over it, honestly, each second, it really definitely varies based off of the individual conditions from each location. And it's something that we're going to be taking into account.
I'm sorry, Bob. Go ahead again. I couldn't hear you.
I'm sorry. I'm wondering, is this going to be an ongoing study then? So you check periodically, even once a year, twice a year, and then based on the data points that you have, water, rainfall and so forth, you can get an idea of how it is affected by water table?
That's absolutely our goal. Now, we're at step one, and that's probably about step five or six down the road. But that's absolutely our goal, is to create a sustainable research program that can go on for decades.
Fantastic. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob, for the question. And let me remind our listeners, if you have a question about this research, about methane as it relates to climate change, whether you think our guests can answer it or you're trying to stump them, that's fine too. This is our monthly science roundtable and a great time to ask those questions. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. John Kessler is here, Associate Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester, and helping lead this new research project. And Nicola Weissman's here. She's a class of 2018 Environmental Studies major who's participating in the research. And I got a couple of written questions that come from listeners, and we'll take them one at a time. And these are Very different questions. I'll start with Jake. Jake always weighs in on science matters. And this is, I think, a very interesting question. He says, quote, "I fully support this research as it expands our understanding. But as I understand it, the primary source of methane going forward is going to be things like methane hydrates in the ocean, a form of solidified methane that turns into gas at warmer water temperatures. Another major source will be methane from thawing permafrost. Basically, our CO2 output is setting off a methane crisis. And I hope your guests can share any insights on those aspects."
Would love to. That's actually the research I would say that I have conducted normally before we are beginning this this research initiative. That's a big fear. We also refer to permafrost carbon, to methane hydrates as the sleeping giants. They are enormous global reservoirs of carbon, and they're stored up in a very quiet form, and the fear is that they will wake and wreak havoc.
They're stored up where? Stored? How are they stored?
So the methane hydrates, the first one that was referred to, is a solidified form of methane. That's correct. It's stable at high pressures and low temperatures. Those sorts of conditions are found in the bottom of the ocean. They're found in Arctic regions. And so as those environments warm, the fear is, as the caller correctly stated, that they will decompose and no longer be a solid and convert it to gas, and you get this massive emission.
Before we get to permafrost,
absolutely.
Is that happening even on a small scale at all that we know of, John?
Yes. I had to pause for a second. because it's a very complex issue.
Okay.
We can go throughout the oceans, and we see bubbles coming up from the seafloor. And a lot of these bubbles are right at that edge where hydrates would be stable. I like to think of it as kind of an inverse snow line. We walk up a mountain, and eventually we're going to get to the snow line, and it'll be frozen water on the ground from there on up. But right at that snow line, it's kind of slushy and it's a little wet and everything else. And as we go down deeper in the ocean, where the pressure gets higher, we're going to hit right at that hydrate line where the stability is kind of in flux. And there will be some release and there will be some forming. And at these locations, it's not uncommon for us to see bubbles. The question is, how long have they been going on? Are they accelerating? And are they accelerating? And this is the third question, which isn't necessarily related to the second. Are they accelerating due to human activities? Because there could be some natural changes that cause these to decompose as well. It's an incredibly difficult question to tease out. But nonetheless, it's something that we've studied for a while. One of the, I think, really exciting things that we've discovered in the last 5 years is that there's indigenous bacteria in the water. That once those methane bubbles are released from the seafloor, they dissolve fairly quickly in the ocean water, and these bacteria actually love to eat methane. It was something that has been known about for a while, but what really surprised us was how aggressive they can be. They can really turn into kind of an overdrive situation when they get these elevated releases of methane and consume it on timescales of a few weeks or something of that nature. And that was new and exciting. To us, it was kind of a safety net that the Earth has in place to prevent some of these catastrophic releases to the atmosphere.
A big enough safety net.
I'm not sure what you...
Well, all right, so again, so I warned John, I'm filled with ignorant questions on this kind of a subject. Here's what I'm sort of picturing. I'm picturing in oceans, and we're talking oceanic solid forms of these, methane hydrates, you call
it. It looks like glass in its purest form, like ice. As it starts to decompose, it looks like a snowball.
Okay, so these solids, very deep, and again, at high pressure and low temperatures, I'm picturing them, you know, as they start to sort of melt or decompose, or right. So, if a large amount of them breaks down, do we have enough bacteria? Is there enough of a safety net? In other words, if we rapidly speed up what's going on with those methane stores, is there enough of a safety net to say it's not going to have the catastrophic impact we fear it could?
Again, I think that's an extrapolation that's hard for us to make at the moment. But one of the things that we have noticed in areas where the natural releases are more aggressive, and even where man-made releases were incredibly aggressive, and one of the opportunities that we had to research was the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. We all looked at that as this massive oil spill, of which it was. But because it was coming straight out of the ground and not a more refined, a more refined product from a tanker spill, it had a lot of natural gas associated with it, of which methane was a major component. So during 2010, during that disaster, there was some of the highest methane concentrations in seawater that we have ever observed. And the background population of bacteria was certainly not in its natural state capable of handling all that. But with that increased food that was there, they bloomed up, they replicated, and we almost had at certain times in certain locations, a pure culture of these very populated organisms as they grew in response to this restocked buffet, if you will. And so that does give the sense that potentially they can come and handle some of these releases. But there's a host of questions that can go that can follow on from that. Mm-hmm. If they, number one, are there regions where they can't? Are there limiting, say, nutrients or vitamins in the water that they need to survive that certain locations just don't have in their seawater? If we do have this huge bloom of bacteria, what happens to it? It will.
Yeah, that was my next question. If they've got the methane, then, or if they're sort of eating the methane as you describe it,
right?
Are they a problem then?
Well, I view them much like I view myself. I'm going to eat more things. I'm going to get fatter. As I get older, I'm going to reproduce. And these are the same things that these cells do as well. But as I eat something, I also exhale carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. and so do these organisms. So, you know, we can't look at it as saying, well, all of this methane is taken away and it's alleviated.
It's
this
not
problem.
A get out of methane free card.
Absolutely not. In fact, we're converting it to carbon dioxide, which can then be released to the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas. One of the things we hear about a lot in the media is ocean acidification. And that is carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere dissolving in ocean water. And that reacts with seawater to actually form an acid.
So if we get more CO2 in the atmosphere, couldn't we speed up that process? Isn't there sort of a loop that could speed up here?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And so if we're looking at methane in the waters and it's being eaten by bacteria and it's being converted to carbon dioxide, we could potentially accelerate the acidification process of the ocean as well. So there's a whole host of questions that cascade down from this. And it's an area that is of active research, one that we're involved with, but a lot of people else are as well. But certainly all the answers are not known as of today.
Okay. And then on permafrost, how does it relate to permafrost?
Well, permafrost, I like to view permafrost as broccoli in my freezer. Permafrost is frozen carbon in Arctic regions, more or less frozen below ground. And I can leave my broccoli in my freezer for years, and it's going to still stay that green broccoli. Maybe I won't want to eat it in 10 years from now, but it'll still be there. I take that broccoli out of my fridge, out of my freezer, and I put it on the countertop. And in about a day, it's going to look like mush. And the same sort of thing is happening right now in the Arctic. The Arctic is experiencing some of the most aggressive changes in temperature around the planet. And a lot of this frozen ground is beginning to thaw. As it begins to thaw, it starts to turn to mush. And as that decomposes, it produces greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide and methane in its release to the atmosphere. That's one which could potentially be a huge source. But again, there's a lot of research that needs to be done on how aggressive this actually is in certain locations. Are there bacteria like there are in the ocean, maybe in soil, maybe in streams and lakes as well, that can start to react to consume some of this? That larger cycling of greenhouse gases into various carbon stores, that carbon cycling, as we like to call it, is an area, again, of very active research.
Okay. Well, I would suggest then, if you want to put methane in something that never breaks down, just put it in Twinkies. If you could just put, like, just big project. That would be, and Jake actually follows up with this very, very interesting theory. He says he calls this the nifty random methane theory. It very possibly explains some of the disappearances in the Bermuda Triangle. In high concentrations, it can stall piston airplane engines flying low and can capsize boats. He says, I don't buy it 100% yet, but what else would you say? Have you ever heard that?
Absolutely.
You have heard that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Methane for the Bermuda Triangle?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yes.
See? I told you we were going to learn things about methane. that we did not know.
Very rarely do we actually see bubbles of methane bursting the surface of the ocean. And the Bermuda is in a fairly deep area of the ocean. So it's very difficult to get bubbles from that deep.
So you're not buying this?
I'm going to have to see a lot of data before I'm sold on it. I'm skeptical
at
the moment.
You're an evidence guy. That's good. Nicola, are you buying it?
I'm going to have to follow along with John here. Okay. I need those data points.
All right, so let's do this. Let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back. Rich has a question regarding methane and livestock, and we're going to get back to some of the research that is going on, brand new, just a few weeks old. And as you heard John Kessler mention, research in the Great Lakes, methane in the Great Lakes, the impact on climate change. We'll talk a little bit more about how they're designing what they will be studying and, you know, if all goes well, you know, what we think we might be able to do with it. What's the practicality and sort of the application of this? So let's get our break and come right back with our monthly Science Roundtable. Coming up in our second hour, we talk about the music of strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. It's a new documentary showing on Saturday at the Little Theater, and it discusses this project that began in 1998 that seeks to see just how powerful music can be in breaking down differences, breaking down barriers, bringing together people from different cultures and continents. We'll talk about all of that and more next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Seneca Park Zoo, with over 250 animals, including African elephants, Bornean orangutans, and more. Guests can experience programming like zookeeper chats and animal feedings every hour of every day this summer. SenecaParkZoo.org. And Turning Stone Resort and Casino, presenting the Bacon Brothers, a folk rock band led by brothers Michael and Kevin Bacon, at the Showroom this coming Saturday, July 16th. Ticket and event information online at turningstone.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and our guests from the University of Rochester are talking about a new research project looking at methane in the Great Lakes as it relates to climate change. But as we've been discussing with our guests, methane, of course, comes from a number of different sources around our planet, and it is most certainly impacting our atmosphere. We're learning more about that with more research, and some of your questions focus on the various sources and what we know or don't know about methane and the impact on climate change. So the next up is Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
How you doing?
Very good.
I want to touch on the effects of livestock industry. You know, I watch Cowspiracy, and like any other show, you wonder if what they said was totally true as far as the levels of methane being produced by our livestock industry. And with that methane being produced, how is that affecting the Great Lakes, if that's true, if what they were saying was true?
Well, first of all, Rich, let me just jump in and say that having had one of the producers of the film on this program and looked into the film, one of the arguments that the film makes, Cowspiracy, is that that the agricultural industry is doing more damage and more of an impact on climate change than the fossil fuels industry, and that's a big claim. They cite a number of statistics. What I found was that that the data backs up the idea that the agricultural industry is no doubt having a significant impact on climate change, and it might be equal or close to equal to the fossil fuel industry. There's one particular piece of data that indicates it is a lot more. The filmmakers focused almost solely on that. I asked them if they were cherry-picking or picking one piece of data when the rest of the data was more mild, but that doesn't mean that it was indicating no impact. And they said that they went with what they thought was the data that would help them tell the story, and they thought tell the story fairly, which is the agricultural industry is absolutely having an impact. So you can draw your own conclusions on the presentation, but certainly we know from science, we know the data indicates there is absolutely an impact. The question is sort of how much. So, Rich, you're asking our guests what to sort of weigh in on what we know about the impact of methane from livestock on other water sources, or what are you asking specifically, Rich?
Yeah, the livestock, and even on the runoffs, because, you know, some of the byproducts of the runoffs is methane, and it's running into the ocean, into the Great Lakes from this area.
Okay.
You know, just for all the agriculture, livestock, and all that. And how big of an effect is even that runoff having on the Great Lakes as far as methane production?
All right, Rich, stay on the line, and we'll start with John Kessler. John?
Well, I'll do my best to try to answer that as best I can. So livestock is often viewed as a really big source because it goes straight to the atmosphere. One of the things that we were just talking about a little bit are these organisms, these microorganisms that are capable of consuming methane. And when it's released below ground, below water, those organisms are there and they can help to mitigate that methane release. But livestock, it goes directly to the atmosphere. There is no biofilter there that helps to remove it. So they can be a really aggressive source. The fossil fuel industry with natural gas, if there's leaky pipes or just the straight venting of some of that, can also be a direct source of methane to the atmosphere. So it can be significant. Now, methane can dissolve back in water. If it's high enough in the atmosphere and it's low enough in water, it'll just dissolve straight back in. And there's certain places around the planet where people have actually done this research, and they've seen that the bacteria that are in water, that are in soil, can actually eat some of it. I don't think that's a huge sink in this area, but, you know, we should be able to tell some of those going in. Other components of this, there could be some going into the rivers. Nicola will be able to look at some of that, but also some of the fertilizers, some of the runoff that can be harmful to rivers and the like, that can cause algae blooms, can also potentially influence some greenhouse gas dynamics. And hopefully all of that will start to be able to tease out.
And I think that's one of the things that really interested me most in looking at the waterways in Western New York was we have such an agriculturally driven area throughout the Finger Lakes area. And then even in Rochester, we have a large industry. And both of these sectors have huge impacts on the waterways, on our atmosphere. And I think one of the things that I really wanted to look at with looking at our waterways, looking at the Genesee River, looking at some smaller rivers, is seeing if our waterways do have higher levels of methane, and if these areas are correlated to areas of high agriculture, whether it be livestock or whether it be produce with lots of fertilizers in the area that, as John said, can cause those algal blooms from the large amount of nutrients. But I think it's definitely something that we need to start looking into and need to start looking into our effects on our waterways, on the atmosphere, and especially from this agricultural land use.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Rich, thank you for the phone call. Let me, before I grab our next phone call, just a follow-up on the question on the agricultural industry. Dan says, while we entertain the idea of a carbon tax, we recognize that methane is potentially more damaging to our environment. Does your panel think the animal agriculture industry, especially beef, with its armies of lobbyists, has had any effect on the prioritization of taxing carbon over taxing methane emissions? In other words, Dan's saying the ag industry has a lot to lose if we eat less meat. If we acknowledge that meat production is a big source of methane, the ag industry won't want us to study that, won't want that information out there. John, do we have any evidence that the lobbyists have made a difference there?
I personally have never seen any evidence to that claim. Certainly, I think all of our brains go to the dark side every now and again and think of these conspiracy theories, whether there's some data to support them or not. I really don't know.
Okay, so the bottom line, Dan, is it is not an illogical question to ask. We just don't have any evidence that would connect that. Let me get back to the phones. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John. John, go ahead, sir.
Hey, Evan. I'm got a question in regards to methane and CO2. My understanding is, and Evan knows I'm a big skeptic of man-made climate change.
Yes, go ahead.
But I'm not going to get into that. But I do have a question in regards to the origins of the Earth. Initially, when the Earth started evolving, there was tremendous amounts of methane and maybe even CO2, and green plant life actually evolved because they fed on CO2 and to a certain extent methane and turned it into oxygen, which populated the planet with oxygen. Is that somewhat true, or what's the evolution of that?
I'm fine with that explanation. I'll buy that.
Okay.
I'll agree with it.
Okay.
All right. All right. And any event, I don't want to get into any more detail other than Evan knows my position on man-made global warming. I think a lot has to do with solar activity, and I think a lot of man-made climate change theories are driven by degrowthers who have, unfortunately, have a lot of momentum in the scientific community, and it's being driven to kind of depopulate the economic vitality of the United States and Western industry.
Yeah, I definitely think, John, that scientists want to see economic destruction. Or not. But anyway, we've covered the solar thing. I mean, I've had guests far more schooled than I am answering the question on whether it's all the sun, and they always explain that it's not. And John, who I like a lot, always doesn't buy that. But that's fine. Neither here nor there. Let me go back to the question on the research. So, John, the research is, what is it, a $10,000 grant that helped get this going? Is that right?
Yeah, this is some preliminary funding that we've received from the University of Rochester very generously to go out and make some preliminary measurements to get some data, and then to use that understanding to hopefully put together some larger projects that we can submit to other organizations, be them private or public, to hopefully continue and sustain some of this research.
All right. So we've been talking about evidence. What evidence do we have? Is there any evidence that the U of R is funding this research in order to help to destroy the global economy?
No, I don't think so. But
you don't know that the answer is no. Okay, so we don't have any evidence that the answer is yes. But let's talk about what you're going to be doing now, because you're going to go this year until winter stops you. So what is a typical, you know, when Nicola and the team and you you're putting together these projects, these expeditions, what's it look like? You know, how do you figure out how you want to measure it and what exactly you do? Can you walk me through a little bit of that?
Yeah, sure. It is a lot of fun, I have to admit.
It's fun?
It's so much fun. We're incredibly busy this summer, and if it wasn't so enjoyable, I would I'd be out of here in a second. It's just too much. But what we do on boats ranging in size from a simple rowboat all the way up to world-class research vessels, which will house upwards of 50 people with some very sophisticated scientific equipment. But on all of this range of size of research vessels, we essentially have a normal scientific lab at a university that you would stereotypically envision in your mind with beakers and glassware and spectrometers and bubbling test tubes. Anything that we know or we're fairly confident won't break, we're going to liquidate out of our lab, and we're going to reset it up on this research vessel. They're floating laboratories for us. And so on this specific one, it's on the smaller size of boats. It is about the size of a charter fishing boat that you'd do on Lake Ontario. We bring our equipment out. We set it up. We run it all off of a generator. We pump seawater up. We take some sediment samples from the bottom of the lake. We try to make as many measurements right then and there.
How deep is the lake, by the way, John?
It depends on where we're at. Mm-hmm. And it depends on which lake you are on. But I think the deepest part of it is about 200 meters. Is that correct, mm-hmm. Nicola?
About that, yeah. It's definitely deeper than Lake Erie, but it doesn't get as deep as some of the other Great Lakes.
Okay.
It's sort of a nice middle size.
Yep. But our goal is to survey more or less everywhere. It's an enormous region. The more we can make our sampling and our analyses automated, the faster we can steam the boat around and make these measurements as we're underway. So we'd like to do some rivers. We'd like to do some coastal regions. We'd like to do some of the open lake regions and some of the deep waters as well, and see if we can get a good general understanding on what's going on.
All right, so forgive my ignorance. So let's say you go out on the vessel, you mentioned seawater, also sediment,
yeah,
from various positions. First of all, you're just looking for how much methane you're finding, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and then how do you use that information? How do you determine if there is a spot that has significantly more You know, what can you do with that? How can you, first of all, determine why it might have more and then what you can do about that?
Yeah, so those are both excellent questions. And that's...
You're way too kind to the interview.
No, not at all. Because this is exactly the scientific process that we go through on almost any project. The first thing we want to see is, where is it? And so we try to do some detailed maps of an environment that we're looking at, be it at a lake, at an ocean, what have you. And some of these autonomous instruments that we set up on the research vessel that pump water up and analyze it continuously as we go on give us that information. We've got a GPS on board so we can correlate it with space. After we do that, though, the very next thing, like you said, is, well, why is it there? Where is it coming from? And one of the techniques that we and almost every geoscientist uses is we actually look at the individual molecules of it, the isotopes of those molecules. What makes up a methane molecule? Well, we've got carbon and we've got a few hydrogen atoms. If we look at those, the particles that make up, let's say, the carbon atom of this, the different sources have different types of carbon atoms. And this comes down to radiocarbon dating something. Is the carbon old? Is the carbon young? And so we actually can measure the isotopes of this, those subatomic particles, and whether it's coming from agricultural production or it's coming from, say, the fossil fuel industry or from a natural seep coming from a fossil fuel reservoir, will have very different isotopes of that methane. And so we want to measure those to help us to determine. We actually call them isotopic fingerprints, where that's coming from. It's actually one of the techniques that's used to fingerprint atmospheric greenhouse gases as coming from, say, CO2, for example, coming from the combustion of fossil fuels. Let's look at the isotopes of this. They're very unique for what is coming from the combustion of fossil fuels. Okay, that must be where it's coming from rather than some other natural mechanism. We do the exact same things in the lake as well.
Okay, and ultimately, this research could go on for how long?
Well, this specific project, this specific funding is going to last throughout the year. Our sampling will last till the end of the year. It'll take us another year or so to analyze the data, get a good understanding of it. But our goal is to have this be a much larger sustainable project. And honestly, that is mainly driven by the unknowns. It's great to be able to work in our own backyard, to be able to wake up at my house and go research and come back and sleep in my own bed. But if the questions aren't there, and if there aren't, isn't there an urgency to have those questions be answered now, this research will fade and die. So it really just depends on what we find this summer. If the questions are numerous, then we'll be out there for the next decade or longer. But if there's only a few little additional things we need to do, then maybe another year or two to really tie off those loose ends.
And for those who might have missed the earlier part of the conversation, if you've got enough of a sample this summer, and then you've got a year or two to complete research, maybe even follow-up work with enough funding and prioritization in the next few years, 3 to 5 years from now, what's the contribution? What do you think the practical application to science can be from this?
For me, it's feedbacks to a changing climate. We are absolutely in a changing climate. And even the skeptics out there will acknowledge that the climate is different today than it was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And as things warm up, will these natural environments and lakes are being shown to be increasing sources of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, will they start to accelerate as well and be a larger source of these greenhouse gases? We can mitigate a lot of the man-made sources of greenhouse gases, but if the natural ones are there spewing out ever-increasing amounts, we may not gain that much. So our goal is one of understanding. How much are these emitting? How is it related to a changing climate? And based on that information, then I think we can make some more informed decisions on how we progress going forward.
And Nicola, what are you most excited about learning? Because you both indicated you think this is a fun project.
Oh, definitely. I've always been a big fan of just, honestly, even just getting out there and collecting the data. But I don't know if there's a part that I'm most excited about, other than just really being out there and getting the experience, being out in the water, being learning how to use these new instruments, learning how to process the data. Really, it's that's sort of driving me to keep going on with this.
Very good. We got about a minute left. Last question. Email from Alex. A listener wants to know, should we be less concerned about methane because Alex heard it mentioned earlier in the hour that it stays in the atmosphere for not as long as other potential greenhouse gases, John?
It's really difficult to generalize it that much.
Okay.
It absolutely has a shorter lifetime in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. But as some of the things that we mentioned earlier, it's more reactive in the atmosphere, helping playing a role in ozone-related processes. On a molecule-by-molecule basis, it is absolutely more intense at absorbing heat than carbon dioxide is. For all of these reasons, we can't ignore it in comparison to CO2. And we also can't elevate it above it. There are two issues that I think our government really needs to take seriously and look at them together.
Well, I want to thank both of our guests for their expertise in guiding us through this conversation on methane as it relates to climate change. And it will be interesting to follow the research that John Kessler, Nicola Weissman, and the team at the University of Rochester are doing. It's underway now. We'll see how much they get done this year. And I hope you'll come back, you know, whether it's the end of this year or more realistically, you've had a chance to analyze the data over the next few years, come back and share with us what you found. We'd love to have that.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Nicola. Nice having you here. John Kessler, Nicola Weissman from the University of Rochester, and our monthly science roundtable. Short break, and when we come back, a conversation about the power of music. And a question that is not meant to be trite, it's meant to be serious. Can a piece of music stop a bullet? That's next hour.